Wow. My name is Catherine Wood, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Catherine.
And I appreciate the honor of sharing my story with you guys. Thank you, Jerry, for asking me to be here and to do that. And I also want to thank you guys for being part of a group that allows me to come in here and do this, share my experience with you tonight without guilt or shame or judgment. I drank and drugged over shame for many, many years, and it's very freeing for me to come in here and not feel that with you guys tonight as I share my story. So I want to acknowledge that there are some people who came in support of me tonight, and I appreciate you being here. I love you guys very much, and I definitely want to acknowledge my dad, Tony Webb, who's here, and my 13-year-old daughter, Katie, who is one of my twin daughters, and I'm happy that she's here with us. And it might shock you guys when you hear what I share, that she's here with us in the audience to hear this, but the truth of the matter is she lived it. And she deserves to know the truth about alcoholism and addiction because it's all over our family. Mental illness, alcoholism, and addiction is all over our family, and nobody knows my story better than she does. She said, "Mom, make sure you bring your tissues. You're going to need them." And I always do. So I'll start with my sobriety date. My sobriety date is November 6th of 2006. It took me a really, really long time to get there, and a lot of pain and a lot of devastation caused by my addiction. I was born and raised in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm a native, and I was born to an alcoholic mother, and her alcoholism was severe. I have an older brother who's 18 months older than I am and a younger sister who's 18 months younger. And so we were like three babies in 3 years for her, and her alcoholism had a really traumatic effect on us when we were growing up. And I remember, you know, I'm going to share a couple of things with you because it did affect how I grew up and kind of the ideals that started for me at a very young age. It started my lack of trust for other people. I can remember, I mean, it was so, my mom was the most amazing, beautiful woman that I've ever known. And she went on to have 30 plus years of sobriety and made her life's work helping other alcoholics. But when she was in her addiction, there was a lot of neglect in our home. And I can remember, and my sister and I laugh about it today, like, what made me think of doing this? But when we were toddlers, I would talk my sister into taking off her clothes and go to the neighbor's house so that they would feel sorry for us and give us food. You know, because my mom was passed out. She just was not able to be the kind of mom that she was sober the way that she drank. And so my mom lost custody of the three of us when I was 6 years old. And we ended up in what I consider to be the worst of the two evils in my dad's home. And he was, it's hard for me to say whether or not he was an alcoholic. He was absolutely a hard drinker, and he was a very violent man. He was verbally and physically abusive, and he was very angry with my mom. And so when he took on custody of us, he had remarried and had a six-year-old stepdaughter. And you know, he was living the life. He didn't have the responsibility of all these children. And so he was very, very angry that we were in his custody. I was very aware of that. And he was just horribly abusive. And so my mom was in and out of treatment during that time trying to get sober. And she eventually got a call from one of my dad's neighbors who said, you know, these children are really in bad condition. You need to come, you know, you need to do something about it. And so my mom, at 6 months sober, not having a whole lot of money, my dad had a lot of money, she took him back to court, and on the day that she was awarded custody, her sponsor, back then in the day that my mom got sober, you know, it was not uncommon for women or men to be sponsored by the opposite sex. Sometimes couples would sponsor people. This was back in the 70s. And so she had a couple that was sponsoring her, and the man, Jimmy Johnson, one of the men that had been in the program for a long time around then, had testified on her behalf on the stand and then had a heart attack. And my dad, I can remember as a little girl all of this going on. My dad gave him mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, but he didn't make it. So the day that she got her kids back, she lost her sponsor. And so I know, you know, my mom was, I'll say this and I can't say it enough, she was one of the most amazing, strong, courageous, brave women that I've ever known. She helped more alcoholics than anybody I know. But I remember thinking to myself, like, she was in a very fragile state. And she was making $4 an hour working at Peachford as the aftercare coordinator and couldn't support us. So she went back to work. And what that left us with was a home with three unsupervised children who really didn't have the tools to survive. We were angry. We had been passed around. We were all traumatized, by the alcoholism that had existed, the abuse that had existed, and we took it out on each other. And so I share that with you because it was really during those years for me that I decided, A, don't rely on anybody, B, don't trust anybody, and C, and this was the most damaging thought that entered my mind at that time and stayed with me for years, when I get older, I'm going to have the perfect family. I'm not going to do this to my children. I'm going to be the perfect wife. I'm going to be the perfect mother. And that would really come back to haunt me. And so, I fell elementary school, adolescence. I fell behind in school. I didn't fit in. I ran away from home and really absent of much alcohol or drug use at all. I mean, I think I had dabbled with alcohol a little bit at this time. My parents, without knowing what else to do with me, took me beginning of 10th grade. I had run away from home and was staying somewhere else, and they put me in Peachford Hospital on the psychiatric ward, and I don't even remember how long I was there, maybe a few weeks, and then they took me out and I moved back to my dad's. My dad said, you can't handle her, move her back over here, and for a long minute, it was kind of like that geographical change. For a long minute, I held it together. I was popular in school. I excelled. I was on the senior council. But that didn't last very long. All my friends at the end of high school went off to college, playing. And I tried to do that in the first semester. I failed out. And around that time, I began pretty heavily abusing alcohol and cocaine. Cocaine was really big around that time. And I do want to say this. I am an alcoholic first. I'm in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I have a lot of respect for this program. This is where I share my fellowship. This is where I got sober. But drugs are a part of my story. And I'll try and keep that to a minimum, but there's no way of really sharing my story with you guys without including that. So young adult, really from about the end of high school until my mid-20s, 25, 26, I was horribly in the Buckhead party scene. Thursday to Sunday, it was just a lot of alcohol, a lot of cocaine. I managed to rack up two DUIs. There was another time where I was a passenger with someone who was driving a car, and I had passed out, from excessive drinking in the passenger seat, and he had run off the road up onto the curb, and a MARTA police officer tried to do kind of like a citizen's arrest on us until she could get the actual police there. And I don't remember any of what happened, but apparently they woke me up out of a passed out state. And the next morning I woke up in jail, charged with terroristic threats against an officer, criminal destruction of property. I mean, it was really a blackout drinker. And so I just don't remember any of it, but I know that I was very violent, very drunk. And so around the age of 26 was when I knew that I didn't drink like other people. I was starting to recognize, everybody else goes home, it's late at night, I'm wanting to drink. Where's the rest of the alcohol? I started to notice how much I would panic when they weren't selling alcohol anymore and I couldn't buy it. On the way home from dropping everybody else off. DUIs did nothing to even slow down how many times I drank and drove. Like, it's frightening when I look back on it. And a friend of mine who ran in some of the same circles ended up taking his own life, and it was over a drug debt that he had. And at that time, a lot of my friends that I'd gone to high school with were getting married. They graduated college. I could kind of see where I was at a crossroads. And for whatever reason, I still had I still had the ability to control to some level. I hadn't crossed that line yet, and I said, if I continue like I am going, I'm going to end up like him. I'm never going to get married. I'm never going to have kids. And so I kind of just made this decision at that time to cut everybody off. I didn't go to his funeral. I didn't return any phone calls. I ended up getting myself a decent job. I was able during this time after I'd failed out of school and off and on periods of you know, somewhat sobriety to get a real estate license and a paralegal degree. And I went and got a job in that field, a really good job, and I met my first husband. And what I can tell you about that time period, I was not drinking alcoholically regularly, but I used that addictive mind of mine in planning a wedding and in 2 years of trying to get pregnant, because I thought that would fix me. I really thought that that's what was wrong with me, that I lacked that, and, you know, I'd always had this ideal in the back of my mind that I was going to create a different life and childhood for my children than my mom and dad had created for me. And so, you know, I was able to do that, and what happened was, you know, everything that I had imagined would happen with me when I got married and had kids, none of it was even realistic. And so, you know, there were problems pretty quickly on in the marriage. I attributed that to the 2 years of infertility that we suffered. And again, just kept going back to really, you know, I just need to be a mom. I just want to be a mom. And that was really all I ever wanted to do. And so 2 years of infertility treatments, and finally, you know, the fourth time that we attempted this one treatment, it worked. And I ended up pregnant with twin girls. And, you know, again, that whole idealism of just, oh, it's everything I've ever wanted. I'll only have to be pregnant one time and I'll have both my kids. And you know, and it's kind of, I guess, what every woman kind of dreams about. Like, the baby comes out and then you breastfeed it and then you swaddle it and you take it home and life is just perfect, you know. And that's not what happened. And I ended up having complications during that pregnancy, and I ended up in the high-risk perinatal unit at Northside Hospital, and they delivered the girls 7 weeks early due to complications. And sweet Katie Bug was 5 pounds, but her and she had some complications at birth, and her little sister was only 3 pounds. And she ended up being in the NICU for about a month. And so everything was spiraling out for me. Like, all this whole idea, and like, I was overwhelmed, and I didn't feel like I could control anything, and I was a nervous wreck. You know, they sent both girls home after being in the NICU for about a month. They sent them home from the feed and grow unit at Northside at 4 pounds. And I thought, aren't they going to send a nurse? Like, I don't have any idea what I'm doing. My husband and I were at each other. You know, he was overwhelmed and stressed out. I was overwhelmed and stressed out, and this whole... Again, the shattering of the ideal. That was really the main thing that was going on with me. And I was, the more out of control I felt, the more I would try and hold it together. Like, you know, and so I would do my best to keep up. I would dress them up in their little matching monogrammed outfits and take them off to have their picture made. And like, that was just a glimpse of really nothing that was really going on behind the front door of the house. I mean, it was horrifying. I had been I had really suffered great efforts to control my whole life, but when you have premature kids, you know, you, before they were born, you could eat off the floor in my house, and after they came home, you couldn't see the floor, and I was just constantly spinning. Like, I wasn't the type of mom that could stay very calm when they were crying, and they were crying all the time. They were 4 pounds. They did not allow us to schedule them, and so I was extremely sleep deprived. They wanted us to feed them whenever they cried so that they would gain weight, and all of these things that were going on kind of created the perfect storm for me. And I come from a super small family. I had one uncle who died at a fairly young age. He was mentally ill with schizophrenia, and he had a heart attack at a young age, and I never had any other uncles or aunts and no cousins. So I came from a really small, you know, southern, tight-knit family. And when I stopped, let me kind of slowly go through this. I stopped breastfeeding the girls when they were about 4 months old, and the drinking immediately started. The smoking cigarettes immediately came back in. you know, just felt like completely coming out of my skin all the time. And so I started drinking, and I was really relieved to be able to do that again and to be able to smoke cigarettes again, and just was kind of trying to find this relief that I felt like I was. It was just a nonstop craving for relief, for sleep, for anything that would make me feel better. And when they were 8 months old, my grandmother died. And she had a very long life, and she'd had cancer for a long time off and on, and she passed away. But the worst part of that was when we were at her funeral, my dad said, "I'm not feeling well." And my dad and I had kind of resolved our relationship over the years. And he suffered a medical condition that caused him to be in a degenerative spinal condition that caused him to be in a on a cane and a push wheelchair and eventually in an electric wheelchair. And he had very limited use. It all stemmed from a car accident that he had before I was born. But it was degenerative. And so he had some health issues, but he said, "I'm not feeling well," and we just thought he was coming down with a cold. And he literally ended up, from her funeral, when my girls were 8 months old, not being able to attend her graveside service and going into Piedmont Hospital with pneumonia, and he passed away from pneumonia literally a month and 2 days after my grandmother did. And so it was crushing to our family, absolutely crushing to lose two people like that so close together. And the most important thing that happened to me at that moment was, you know, that I was just up to here. I remember when I finally went to treatment, they said, you know, the goal of treatment is for us to clean out your internal trash can and then to give you the tools to keep your trash can cleaned out. And I mean, I was just up to here. And I could not find relief unless I was daily drinking. And so my crossing the line didn't happen for me slowly. It wasn't a gray area. Literally the day that my dad died, I started drinking every night. And the efforts to control came in. That's really when I started noticing exactly what the book talks about in the efforts to control. I would say, "I'm only going to start drinking at 5 o'clock, you know, and that would move up to 4 o'clock. And I won't get that drunk again tomorrow night because I'll eat dinner. I really messed up and I should have eaten dinner." And there was one time where I said, you know, I was noticing what would happen was I was a blackout drinker. And so I would drink, I would not eat so that I could get drunk quicker once I put the kids to bed. And they were two and a half at this time. I would not eat dinner so that I could get drunk quicker, and I would end up in a blackout. And I would wake up the next morning and not know. There would be candles lit in the house that I hadn't blown out. I wouldn't remember if they'd woken me up, you know, to come in and change their pacifier, or if they'd been crying. I was starting to get really terrorized by my own actions. And so I decided one night that I was only going to buy one bottle and that I was, you know, just going to drink that one bottle and I'm going to get so drunk. And that's how I'm going to control it. And I drank that one bottle and that obsession had started. And not only was I not able to stop at that one bottle, I left my children at home and put myself in a car drunk to go get another bottle. And that's when I just knew. I remember that time period very well in my alcoholism because I had lost control completely. I could not control my drinking. I could not drink, and when I started, I couldn't stop. There was no controlling how much went in, and when I drank to pass out. And it was a very, very scary time. And so, rightfully so, my family intervened me in the summer of 2003, and I'm going to share my honesty about that right now. My main reaction to that intervention, my husband was drinking a lot at that time too. He was probably drinking around the same amount that I did, but he didn't have the same kind of consequences. He didn't black out. He is a member of this program today, but at that time, our drinking looked very different. But he became my target of anger when they intervened me, you know, and my reaction to the intervention was, I have taken care, internally, this was my reaction, I have taken care of these kids. You know, I'm the only one who's taking care of these kids, and I've worked my ass off to keep everything going. And he's a liar. He's a liar because he didn't tell anybody that he drank as much as I did. And so my real goal when I was in Betty Ford in 2003 was to come home and kick him out of the house. I'll keep everybody off my back so that they won't take these children away from me, because that was just my biggest fear. And I'm going to come home and he's going to be gone. And that's exactly what I did. I came home. I pretended to go to meetings. I manipulated the counselors there into letting me get home to my kids because I kept telling them that they needed their mom there to be potty trained. They were 2.5 years old at that time. And so I was the great pretender, but I had no intention on quitting drinking. I didn't. And I'm going to tell you guys something that was really harmful for me in treatment. And it fed exactly what my disease needed to hear, and that was I happened to be in Betty Ford at that time with people who had a lower bottom than I had at that time, and they dubbed me, the other patients in treatment dubbed me the wine sipper, because I wasn't doing meth and I wasn't, you know, and that was really damaging for me, you know, to be considered, you know, what I heard a lot in treatment was degrees of addiction. And it gave me the perfect excuse to go back home and drink. I'm the wine sipper. And that was not the truth at that time. And so I came home, and the great lie began, the hiding. And so I would hide the bottles in my closet until my husband, who I came home and quickly kicked out of the house, until he came over to visit the kids. And then I would go get the bottles out of the closet and stick them in the freezer until they were cold enough to drink, which probably, you know, wasn't very long. And the minute he left, I would start drinking as fast as I could drink, get as drunk as I could get. The kids were in bed. And the next morning, I would pack the bottles up in their diaper bag and drive them to preschool and dump them off at the carpool line and dump the bottles in the dumpster. And then I would shop liquor stores. You know, my ridiculous how I thought really that nobody knew what was going on with me, but I would go around and pretend like I was having parties. So I'm having parties. You know, I want to try several different types because I'm having a party. And I would say that to 2 or 3 different liquor stores. And it was just this constant thing that went on. I didn't hold it together very long doing that. And so, oh my goodness, I started to hide my phone from myself because I would make phone calls in a blackout and I wouldn't remember them and I would slur my words, and then the next morning I would wake up with that terror that the book talks about and check my phone, oh my God, who have I called? And I was scared of myself, and I know that only the people in this room will understand this rationale, but my rationale at that time was, well, I just need to do cocaine again, and that way I won't get so drunk that I slur my words, and so I'm just going to hook back up with the cocaine dealer. And that made all the sense in the world to me at the time. It was like, I'm the smartest person on the planet. Why didn't I think of that before? And so that's what I did. And I was not a good mom during that time. There were times where my children missed preschool because I'd been up all night using drugs. There were times when they were out in the backyard and I was in the house using drugs and watching them through the window. I tried the best I could to hold it together, and my family knew that I was not sober, and they attempted again in the summer of 2004 to intervene me, and I promptly told them all to get out of my house. And I'll never forget what my dad said at that time, because I had venomous anger at everyone in the family. Like, how dare you question my mother, my parenting skills, and I'm the greatest mother on earth, and despite, you know, everything that's been thrown at me, I've held it together, and this is just all that went on in my mind. And I felt in my addiction, as crazy as it sounds, betrayed by them. You know, nobody gives me any validation for how hard it's been that you know, I've had these premature kids and that my marriage fell apart, and yet you all accuse me of being an unfit mother. And so I had venomous anger toward my family, but I didn't toward my dad. He had played a really, really kind of diplomatic role with me, and he said something to me at that intervention that stuck out, and I never forgot it. And he said, "Sweetheart, we can't all be wrong. We can't all be wrong." And I remember telling them all to get the F out of my house, and I'll sue you if you don't bring my children back immediately. And that kind of severed all ties with my family. That really gave me permission, which every addict needs, in my opinion, to sever ties with the family so that I can continue doing what I need to do. And that's what I did. And so around that time, you know, I was frightened to live in my home by myself. So around that time, I rented my basement. I lived, and this just shows you guys, I will use this as an illustration of how this disease doesn't discriminate. I was living in a $600,000-$700,000 house in Buckhead. I was driving a Lexus. I wasn't working, and I was as empty as I've ever been on the inside. And so I have in this large home with my two children, and I was scared to death, really, to be there. And my husband and I, when we were married, had rented out our basement apartment prior to that. And so when he moved out and we're, you know, in the midst of this divorce, I decided that I needed to get another tenant downstairs so that I feel scared all the time. And I'm sure that, you know, this frequent use of cocaine didn't help with that paranoia of being alone in the home. And so I rented my basement apartment out to a couple who in really short order kind of introduced me to crack cocaine. And I had never known anyone who smoked crack, and if I did, I made fun of them. Oh my God, what a crackhead. You know, I thought I was way too good for that. And the bottom line is, I was an addict, I was an alcoholic, and I was desperate enough to do whatever I thought would fix me and make me feel better. And I had no idea how devastating my disease was about to play a role in my life. It was, I was unbelievably addicted to crack cocaine from almost the very minute that I started using it. And three times in 3 weeks, I no-showed picking my children up at preschool. And I have to tell you that I went from being the room mom in their preschool class in Buckhead to losing them in a matter of months. It was just a matter of months. And I thank God for this today, because this bottom was like straight down, where I think I really could have lingered on alcohol and cocaine for a whole lot longer if I had not started smoking it. And I'm grateful for that today. Grateful that my children had a minimal exposure to that compared to what it could have looked like. And so three times in 3 weeks, I no-showed picking those girls up. This is where I'm going to need the tissues, Katie. And 4 months after I took that first hit, DFAX came to my door and took these girls away from me. Love you. And the hardest part about that time was, you know, I knew that everyone hated me for what I was doing as a mom, and what they didn't realize was how much I hated myself. Like, no one could have hated me more than I hated myself. But the cycle of that for me was, I hated myself for not being able to control the drinking and drugging so that I wouldn't lose the kids. And the more I hated myself, the more I would use. And the more I would use, the more I would hate myself. And it was just this cycle that ran almost the whole time that I was using. And so DFAX came and took Katie and Sarah away. And that was really the only thing that I was hanging on to. So when they were gone, it was like, F it, you know? I'm an unfit mother. That's the only thing I ever wanted to succeed at. I'd had this ideal my whole life that, you know, I was going to be the perfect mom. And I didn't have to sit awake and wonder what it was doing to them, because it had happened to me when I was a little kid. So I knew what I was doing to them. And so the next year and a half of my addiction was the most horrifying experience that I can even explain to you guys. I had a lot of money. And I used around the clock. around the clock for the next year and a half. And what that looked like was I would use for 4 days, and then my body would pass out, and I wouldn't know when that was going to happen. And so 6 times in 3 months, I was behind the wheel of a car. And it's a miracle that I can kill somebody. It's just a miracle. I was an absolute non-functional drug addict who I could not function. And so, oh my goodness, so it got really, really bad for me. And my husband was later able to prove in court that I had spent $323,000 on cocaine. I had about a $1,200 a day habit, and my tolerance was very high, and I literally used around the clock. If I was not passed out, I was using. And I would make pathetic attempts to come and see my kids. Everybody made efforts to try and keep me involved in their life, and I just couldn't do it. I couldn't stay well enough to see them. And so I ran out of money. And I'm going to tell you guys my truth at the time, and this is so sick when I look back on it. I really thought that I was too good to do what most women in my position were doing for crack cocaine, and that was prostituting themselves. I thought that I was much too good for that. You know, I'm not ever going to do that. I don't have to do that. And so I don't even know really how it started. I believe that I was trying to return some makeup at Walgreens to get some money. I had run myself out of money for anything. Unable to work, desperately addicted to this drug, and I need to add in that 2 times during this year and a half that I was using, I attempted treatment. And the motive was to get the children back, was to try and put together some amount of sobriety that would help me get my girls back. And it was a joke. And I'm going to tell you how baffling this disease is. I chose outpatient so that I could continue to use because I was terrified to be separated from alcohol and drugs. Terrified. So I chose outpatient, continued to use while I was in outpatient, and then paid for an extra week at Ridgeview thinking, well, maybe if I go an extra week, something will happen to where I want to, you know, I'll be able to quit. It was just absolute insanity. It was an awful, awful, awful time. And after treatment, you know, about a year and a half of using, I had run myself out of money, and I was at the Walgreens returning this makeup, and the manager came up to the lady that was checking me out, trying to return this makeup and get me $5 or $7 back. And the manager said, I need you to start using this. We're taking in a lot of counterfeit. And so, bing, bing, went the alcoholic mind. Counterfeit. That sounds like a fabulous idea to get me out of this bond that I'm in. And at the time, I thought it was. I thought, I'm the smartest person on the planet. Why haven't I thought about this sooner? And I taught myself how to counterfeit $20 bills. And at first it was just with the dealers, and I won't get into details about this, but I put myself in some of the most dangerous situations that you can imagine. I sit here today and I shudder when I think about it. First started out with the drug dealers, and then, you know, once that had run its course and they had all caught on to my game, it was really at retail locations. And so I would give them a fake 20 and buy one item and then get enough money back. And when I'd have enough money, I would be able to go and buy my drugs and the alcohol and whatever I needed. And that was a round-the-clock cycle for me. Make the money, find the alcohol and drugs. Make the money, find the alcohol and drugs. And in June of 2006, I was arrested by the Secret Service. And CNN ran that news piece nationwide using all three of my names. And so WSB ran it locally using all three of my names. And I can't even tell you the embarrassment that I brought my family. My family members had people from other states that we'd gone to high school with calling and saying, what happened to her? Like, what happened to her? And they included my mugshot, and a mugshot of somebody who's been using alcohol and drugs like I had for as long as I had is just unrecognizable. I was unrecognizable. And so the importance of what happened at that time was like, the deal's up. There was nowhere else to hide. I had been trying to get it together for so long. I was out of money, and so I spent 14 days in the Fulton County Jail. And all I thought about the whole time I was in there was, how was I going to get high? How am I going to get high? How am I going to survive 14 days in here without getting high? And I got out, and I talked to my sweet, beautiful, sober mother who had been trying for years to help me get sober, and to giving me $4,000 to pay off my bills and do the right thing. And she did that, and I went on a 3-week run, and that was it. Used every dime of that $4,000, and my family finally realized that they had to take some drastic action to try and motivate me and force me into treatment. And so they told me that they were going to terminate my parental rights, that I was not even going to be able to call the girls. And I just knew that I couldn't do that. Just knew that I couldn't do that. And I was facing 15 years in federal prison. And at the end of my addiction, I'll just kind of summarize what it looked like for me at the end of that 3 weeks. I was living in a place that had no electricity. There was no power. My car had been repossessed. I had no food. When I had gone to jail, the one thing that I'd been left with was my dog, Murphy. And when I was in jail, they took him away. And so I started thinking, you know, the next time I have $60, and I guess somebody had given me that number at one point, one of the creeps that was in the lifestyle that I was living had given me that number as the number that it would take to buy a gun. And so in my head, I started thinking, the next time that I have $60, I'm not going to buy dope. I'm going to buy a gun. Because I can't live like this anymore. I just can't. And I was really so scared. I mean, you guys, I was begging for your change at Quick Trip. That's how bad it was. I was panhandling at Quick Trip. And I was just exactly like the book describes. I was spiritually, emotionally, mentally bankrupt. Financially, I just had nothing left. And I didn't ever believe that I'd get sober. Never. I never believed that I would be reunited with my children. I just didn't think that I was redeemable at all. And so I was terrified that in a bad space of judgment, I was really going to take my life, and that the legacy I would leave for my girls would be that I didn't love them enough to try. You know, and so I did love them enough to try. And so in that dark townhouse surrounded by drug paraphernalia everywhere, I got on my knees and I held the top of my dresser and I just prayed. And I said, God, please do something, because I'm going to die one way or another. I need help. I'm going to die. And the next morning I got up and called somebody, a friend of mine that I'd gone to high school with, who was one of the few people who had not judged me and hadn't turned their back on me. And I said, I need help. I need to go somewhere. And he took me to Mar. And I had absolutely had enough. But I had enough. And I tried as hard as I could. I was in Mar for 4 months. And I tried as hard as I could. And at the end of that four-month period, I was about to graduate, and I broke the rules. And I went to the townhouse where I used to live. I was scared that they weren't packing my things up and that I was going to lose the little bit that I had left. And I went over there, and I said, well, I was in my little, you know, I had my recovery job selling Lancome makeup at Phipps Plaza, and I said, you know, I'm going to go over there and just put some stuff in lawn and leaf bags, and maybe that'll make the process easier. And when I shook that comforter off, some drugs hit the floor, and I was not spiritually fit enough to be there. And I relapsed, and I'm so grateful. My husband was like, please include this in part of your story because it's really crucial to what happened with me. During that relapse, I was using and crying at the same time because it didn't work for me anymore. Didn't work. I was using and crying at the same time, and the drug dealer was yelling at me the whole time saying, what's wrong with you? You know, why are you crying? And I said, you wouldn't understand. And so I had to take a really, really, really hard look at what the book talks about, half measures. And when I looked at what I was doing in that four-month period, I was lying about getting a speeding ticket so I wouldn't lose my driving privileges. I was hiding conditioner and shampoo in bottles that said alcohol-free when they weren't alcohol-free. I was sneaking fingernail polish in my purse. And so I don't think by any means that my God caused me to relapse because I was doing those things, but I certainly was not working a completely honest program. And so I set out from that point in time to work an honest program. I knew I ended up during that 12-hour relapse in a hotel room off Buford Highway with two girls who were prostituting themselves with a guy who was shooting dope and having seizures, and somebody got stabbed in front of me, literally. And this was just kind of that crazy, crazy stuff that goes on out there. And 4 months away from that, and then seeing that for 12 hours, and I could see myself in every one of those people. It was like all of my yets. You know, this is my option is either recovery or alcohol and drugs. And I knew that then, and drugs and alcohol weren't working for me anymore. So I went from Mar. I had a discharge from Mar, and I went to Hope Homes, and I lived at Hope Homes for 6 months. And Beth Fisher, who runs Hope Homes, is one of the most amazing women in my journey of recovery. And she allowed me to reunite with my children at my own pace. And so I got a recovery job at GACA, the Georgia Association of Addiction Counselors, and worked there from 9 to 4 and just kind of an administrative job. And I started working with a sponsor, and I began reuniting with my children. And I have to tell you guys the most important thing in my journey of recovery, and that is that I found a competent sponsor who took me through this book and who taught me how to work the steps as they're designed to be worked and the action that's meant to be taken in the first 164 pages of this book, and it saved my life. Everything that I read in this book made sense to me. It's like, that's why I couldn't quit drinking despite how much I wanted to be a fit mom. You know, that the efforts to control, everything in this book described my addiction. And so during the time that I was in Hope Homes, I worked with a sponsor who took me through one I had done in my mind when I was 26 years old and I knew that I was drinking alcoholically. One was the easiest step I ever worked. I mean, there was nothing left for me to surrender. It was all gone. Two and three, I had some roadblocks. You know, I did, in my mind at that time, have a judgmental God and a punishing God to some extent, and my sponsor helped me to remove those roadblocks so that I'd be able to practice step three on a regular basis. Step four was like, oh, you know, I wanted to purge all that stuff. So even though it was a really scary step for me, I was able to do the work that was asked of me freely and willingly because I was terrified of relapse. I was terrified. I really knew that if I went back out, I was going to die, and it was probably going to be by my own hand, but there was no reservation for me when I came in this last time. And, you know, five taught me how to trust another woman. Like, I hadn't trusted anybody in years. I ended up learning how to trust someone enough to share those deep, dark, innermost secrets with somebody else. And so six and seven was easy enough. She pulled out my character defects from my step four list and was able to point those out to me, and then I was able to ask my God to remove them. Like, what a freedom. Eight and nine, Marty and I talk about this all the time. Eight and nine is where the dope is for me today. And to be forgiven for some of the things that I did, it was unbelievable. It was really remarkable that I got to experience that love, that unconditional love from people who are willing to forgive me for some of the actions that I had taken in my addiction. So 8 and 9, that's probably my favorite step. You know, 10, 11, and 12, I get the opportunity. I shared when I picked up my 8-year chip recently you know, I get the opportunity regularly. You guys, I came into this program and my mess got turned into a message of hope for other alcoholics and gave my life a meaningful purpose, which is nuts. I mean, I was a street crackhead, alcoholic crackhead, unfit mother begging you for change at Quick Trip. And now I'm in a position to share that experience with another alcoholic and drug addict who might be able to benefit from that. And it's just miraculous to me that this program can give us that gift. So step 12 is really a big one for me, too. And so this is my favorite part, and this is where I get to tell you guys what it's like today. A year and a half into my recovery, I got my girls back. I got my girls back, and I get an opportunity every day to make a living amends to them. And they haven't had to see their mom drunk or drugged in 8 years, and that's a miracle. This program gave me back my mom, and it gave my kids back their mom. You know, it's just generations of our family that have been saved by this program. So I lost my dog, I told you guys, when I went to jail. And in recovery, that dog, by the way, still lives with my girls at their dad's house. So he stayed in the family, but in recovery, I have three rescue dogs at home that my husband would accuse of being children to me. And I get the opportunity, you know, to love and care for those pets in ways that I didn't care for Murphy when I had him. I was not allowed in my addiction and following my addiction for years into recovery, actually, to have a checking account at any of the banks that you would have a check. I couldn't have rented an apartment. It's a great thing that my dad and my mom opened their home to me because my credit was ruined. I still, to this day, I have to be honest, can't rent a car at budget for details that I won't mention, but you know, I had ruined my credit, ruined it. I had $150,000 in credit card debt when I came in. I was writing checks for food at the end of my addiction. I was bouncing checks for food, and I was able to make amends to all those people, but it had done enough damage to my credit that it took a long time. Today, 8 years in this program, my credit is perfect. Like, I don't have any financial issues. My legal troubles were solved when I went to see the judge and he realized that I was in recovery. And I explained to him that my addiction had caused me to commit the felony crimes that I was committing in an effort to obtain drugs. And he took mercy on me and gave me the opportunity to stay sober and put me on 2 years probation, which is a miracle. One of the greatest gifts of my recovery was being given the opportunity to take care of my mom. You know, my mom, like I said, had spent the majority of her sobriety. She got sober when I was about 9, helping other alcoholics. She worked at Anchor, Peachford, Ridgeview. She was really instrumental in a lot of people's sobriety, and she had really worked hard to try and bring recovery to me when I was in my addiction, and I did not treat her well. There were times that I pushed her out of my house. I clearly stole her money. I broke her heart on a daily basis. It was terrible. And I really, even having made a formal amends to her, don't feel like there was anything I could have done to make up for what I had done to her. And God gave me that opportunity. And unfortunately, when I was 3 years sober, my mom was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And my girls and I got the opportunity to move into her home once again and to take care of her in the last 20 months of her life. And get ready for the tissues, Katie. In the last 2 weeks of her life, she needed help with pretty much everything. And we were trying to help her change her clothes and get dressed by using a draw sheet. And so I was changing her pajamas, and I was having to use a draw sheet to turn her over and pull her pants up and fix her shirt and button it. And I had to get up on the bed once I had done all that to pull her up in the bed. And when I was up on the bed doing that, and it was probably, you know, less than 2 weeks before she passed away, she grabbed my arm and she said, "You are the best daughter." And that's the gift that you guys gave me.
to get back to her like that. This program made me the mom that my girls deserve, the daughter that my mom and dad deserve, the friend that my friends deserve to have, the wife that my husband deserves. It's all as a result of this program. Like, you guys turned me into that woman from the mess that I was. And so that's one of the greatest gifts this program gave me, was my husband. And like he said, a year and a half ago, we met through 45 shared friends on Facebook, and he is absolutely, without a doubt, my soulmate. And we get to learn how to be in a healthy marriage with each other, and we're both willing to do whatever it takes to do that. And it's not always easy, but we're always willing to do it. And I love him from the bottom of my heart. And it's the greatest gift to get up and meditate with him every day and to come to meetings and for me to support him when he shares his experience and for him to support me and to watch him be the most incredible stepdad that my girls deserve. And they love him with all their hearts. And you know, there's a line in the big book. I know I'm out of time, and I want to just share with you guys this. Part of the big book always gives me chills when I heard it and when I read it, you know, because I know so many people come in and out of this program like I did. So many people come in and they don't make it. You know, I've sponsored a lot of women in 8 years, and they just, a lot of us don't make it. In the doctor's opinion, in the very end, it says, I earnestly advise every alcoholic to read this book through, and though perhaps he came to scoff, he may remain to pray. And I'm so glad that I stayed, you guys. Like, it saved my life. I'm so glad I stayed. And I just try today. My quiet little prayer every day is, God, thank you so much for this gift, and just help me to live a life that's worthy of it. Because it's amazing. Thanks so much for letting me be here, you guys.